Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's my pleasure tonight to welcome you to this first dialogue in the Institute's autumn series on art, imagination, and public service. I welcome you on behalf of the Dean and Chapter. My name is Paul Bauman. I'm the Receiver General here, and as such, I lead the lay administration of the Abbey. I'm also the Acting Chair of the Institute's Steering Group, in which capacity I'm here tonight. As many of you will know, the Institute was founded back in 2013 with a remit to nurture moral and spiritual values in public life and service. And as well as these biannual lecture series, we also run a very active fellows program for aspiring public service leaders and occasional private seminars for government departments and other organizations seeking a safe space to explore challenging issues through the lens of moral values. In previous years, the lectures have tackled topics ranging from justice and democracy to integrity and truth. But I'm particularly excited about this series of dialogues, which seeks to stimulate an imaginative cross-fertilization of ideas by bringing public servants of various types into conversation with artists, poets, and musicians. The location of these events here in the beautiful Lady Chapel of the Abbey could not be more appropriate. It is itself, as you'll be aware, a powerful fusion of some of the finest late medieval architectural art, described by the historian John Leland as the wonder of the world, with a working chapel dedicated to the outstanding public servants honoured by membership of the Order of the Bath. So it's very fitting that this particular fusion takes place here. In recent years, the Abbey has added to the artistic heritage of Henry VII's chapel, particularly through the medium of stained glass, as may well become apparent in the course of this evening's discussion. But before I steal any of their thunder, let me introduce your chair and interlocutor for the evening. Baroness Hale is President of the Supreme Court, which is, of course, one of our closest neighbours on Parliament Square and a key partner in our work here at the Abbey. You may have noticed Baroness Hale being quite busy in recent months with other neighbours around Parliament Square, but that's not the topic for this evening, as far as I know. Like me, you may be struck by the frequency of the word first in the list of Lady Hale's achievements in the biography you have on your seats. You also have information on our speaker, Hugh O'Donoghue, whom she will introduce shortly. So do enjoy what I hope will be a very stimulating evening, and now I hand over to you, Lady Hale, to get the evening properly underway. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much indeed for the invitation. It is indeed a great joy to be in what we can call a safe space. I have not always felt particularly safe in recent weeks, but so it's very good to be here. And we are, of course, talking about envisioning justice, the painter and the judge. So I thought I'd better bring with me the standard symbol of justice, as she is normally depicted. You're all familiar with her, a blindfolded woman holding scales. This one actually is holding a clock, but she's normally holding scales, and a sword, and in this version, standing on a book round which a snake has curled itself. So what does that all mean, do you think? Let's leave her there to preside over us. Well, the scales are a very early image associated with judging and justice, dating back as far as Babylonian times, and denoting, of course, balance or fairness. The sword could go back to the Old Testament times. What about Solomon and various other stories involving swords? Later, the sword of St. Michael, denoting that judges are there both to judge and to punish. The blindfold is more equivocal. Early images showed justice without a blindfold. It came to be associated later on with impartiality, a good thing. But there is a woodcut attributed to Dürer in 1494 entitled The Fool Blindfolding Justice. This is in Sebastian Brandt's Ship of Fools, denoting stupidity or failure to see what is in front of one. So a blindfold is not always a good thing. But ever since that time, justice has been depicted mostly with a blindfold. The book is a later appearance, and I suppose represents legal learning, but I have not been able to find an explanation for the serpent. So if anybody's got one, I'd love to hear it. But the purpose of this dialogue, as envisaged by Claire Foster Gilbert, whom we're so sorry cannot be with us tonight, is to explore how public servants make their decisions, to reveal the values underlying them, and to understand the ways in which we are not, in her words, tyrannized by utilitarianism. Now, most judges will probably say that they're not influenced at all, still less tyrannized by utilitarianism. We are influenced only by the evidence when we're determining facts, and by the legal materials and reasoning when we're determining legal principles applicable to those facts. The Supreme Court is not a trial court. We don't decide facts. The lower courts have done that for us. So we're solely concerned with arguable points of law of general public importance. And the shape of a typical judgment goes like this. Firstly, we try to encapsulate the issue in the first paragraph or two, what the case is about, what the legal problem is. Secondly, we set out the relevant facts and how the case was decided in the lower courts, the trial court and the court of appeal, typically. Thirdly, we try and explain the relevant legal materials, the legislation, and previously decided cases. The Supreme Court is not bound to follow cases decided in the courts below, as they are. So we have got a lot more freedom than they have. Even if necessary, in the interests of justice, we can depart from previous decisions at Supreme Court level. So we don't have to spend a long time trying to reconcile and deduce principles from the lower court decisions. But of course, we are guided by what the underlying principles of law are. And by definition, we are deciding something to which the answer is not clear. So we are, to some extent, making new law in every case. So, fourthly, we explain what the arguments are on either side of the issue. And fifthly, we explain how we reach our own conclusion. So that's how we go about doing our job. We sit in panels of 5, 7, 9, or on two occasions in my lifetime on the court, 11. We try to have a single lead judgment representing the decision and the reasoning of the majority. From this, it becomes clear what the ratio decidendi of the case is. The ratio decidendi is a bit of Latin. We don't mind Latin in our court. But what it basically means is it's the irreducible minimum of the reason why that outcome fits those facts. And that reasoning is binding on the courts below. So we try and have a clear ratio in our cases. Lawyers and academics will sometimes complain that we don't, but we do try. And we usually have one justice who is detailed to write the leading judgment. The other justices can chip in with suggested amendments and improvements. We try to work collaboratively. They can add separate concurrences, but we hope not reaching the same conclusion for different reasons, because that would, of course, confuse everybody as to what the ratio is. They can dissent. It's always possible in the common law tradition for people to disagree with the majority view. This is not so in not the tradition in continental Europe. In the civilian tradition, dissent is an unusual and, in some cases, abhorrent idea. But we think it's not a bad thing. It's a good safety valve, and it also means that the decision of the majority does not have to be a compromise, which compromises principle for the sake of bringing the minority on board. And of course, sometimes today's dissent becomes tomorrow's majority view. I'm just feeling particularly pleased because I dissented in a case to do with something which is officially called the removal of the spare room subsidy, but everybody in this room will know it as the bedroom tax. And I dissented in relation to one aspect of that case, and last week Strasbourg agreed with me. So that's always very satisfying. It doesn't happen as often as it should, but it's very satisfying when it does. But of course, the greater the number of the judges who agree, the greater the authority of the decision. One would like to think that a unanimous decision of 11, all 11 justices of the Supreme Court, had an authority greater than it would have had if it had been a majority decision, especially if the majority had been a narrow one. Now, this process of legal reasoning and collaborative reasoning, or judicial reasoning, is, or at least should be, the opposite of what advocates do. Sir Stephen Sedley, a retired Court of Appeal judge, writing extrajudicially before he became a full-time judge, said that what advocates do is reason from a given conclusion. When you think about it, it's obvious. As an advocate, you listen to your client's story and problem, you work out what the best result that client could possibly hope for from the court, you advise your client that's the best you can do, so don't want more, and then you work out how to persuade the court of that conclusion. So you are basically starting at the end and working back to see how you can get the court to agree with you, whereas we should be starting at the beginning with the legal materials and the legal principles and reasoning from them to the conclusion. I would like to suggest that we always do that, but I think that would be over idealistic of me. I can't be too starry-eyed. We must always treat the conclusion, test the conclusion that we reach against our intuitive sense of justice and practicality. Judges are fond of talking about common sense. I'm very suspicious of common sense. I bet if I put any particular practical problem to the people in this room, there will be five or six views about what the common sense answer was to it. So, but practicality does come into it, and justice certainly comes into it. So you always have to test your conclusion against that. However, there is also a certain amount of pragmatism, if not utilitarianism, built into legal principles. Now, this is what is a bit of a challenge. This year, I've given two big lectures in Cambridge. One was entitled Principle and Pragmatism in Private Law, and the other was entitled Principle and Pragmatism in Public Law. And I found examples where an element of pragmatism was turned into a so-called principle by the law. For example, identifying a new duty of care in negligence is only done where this is fair, just, and reasonable. Now, it sounds like a principle, but basically that's naked pragmatism. And so also in public law, there is a practice of deference, that is respect, to decisions made by public authorities. That too is dressed up as a principle, but actually it's a largely pragmatic consideration as to who is the best able to reach the decision in question in the circumstances in question. So although I've given you this rosy-tinted spectacle idea of how we go about our work, and I'm honest about that is how we go about our work, nevertheless, we do road test it against the end result against a degree of principle, a degree of pragmatism, and the law itself has some concepts which themselves are redolent of pragmatism. So how does all this compare with how a painter goes about his work? So now can I introduce Hughie O'Donoghue to you, who's a very well-known painter of all sorts of different scenes I have seen on the website that you deny knowing anything about. and, of course, a very distinguished academician. So do come and explain how you go about what you
do.
Thank
you, Lady.
And how it differs from what I do.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Hello, good evening. And Thank you for that. You've totally distracted me now, Lady Hale. But I have my threads, because I was absorbed in listening to you, because so many of the terms, not simply judgment, obviously, which judgments are made by artists all the time, but they're trying to fine-tune or judge something, get something specific. But also, I think there's a moral dimension, which is a kind of a fundamental thing. And so there's two things I want to talk about. One is specifically about what I was asked a question by the press department to me. What is it that you've said about artists making judgments that sometimes are in advance of historians? Can you give me an example? What specifically is an example? Because this is something about the truth. Because historians are the vehicle through which most of us learn about the nation, about the place. And Victorian cultural commentator, although he wouldn't have been called a cultural commentator in Victorian times, John Ruskin, made a very famous statement that really, that nations write their autobiographies in three books: the book of their words, the book of their deeds, and the book of their art. And although it's impossible to understand any of these three books without reference to the other, the only one you can trust is the art. Now, what he was saying was something about truth and about how we record events, how things are recorded and how they go into our consciousness. Now, I've read a lot of history, I have to say, over many, many years. And if you doubt that historians are not partial, I would invite you to read accounts of the Dunkirk evacuation from the French perspective, the British perspective, and the German perspective. And although they contain all the same facts, they are remarkably different in their emphasis. And so what I'm saying, in a sense, is that what an artist does is they give emphasis to something. I'm not sure who said all art is storytelling, but I think that's probably quite a good analysis of it, even though a lot of contemporary artists are quite reticent to tell stories. Storytelling is part of it, and I've been quite interested in the resuscitation of history painting. History painting for many years was regarded as the highest form of art. It was the most revered form of art, and it died and fell flat on its face about 150 years ago. And why did that happen? Well, it happened because it was phony, because it was evidently not the truth. So you could look at pictures of Washington crossing the Delaware, or the coronation of Napoleon, or some heroic hussar on a horse somewhere, and think, well, that's really not... that's kind of make-believe. And in answer to the question that said, well, can you explain, can you think of an example? And the example I came up with was a work by an artist called Marcel Duchamp, who I'm sure you've all heard of, that was made in April 1917. And it's called Fountain. And it was cited in a survey of 500 British art world professionals as the most influential work of the 20th century. Now, I'm sure you're all familiar with this work. It is a male urinal that was purchased from a hardware shop in New York, and it was signed by the artist, only he didn't even use his own name. He signed it R. Mutt. And this work is cited as so powerful and influential because it changed, it separated forever the idea of artistic labor from the artist's voice, from the idea of making it. It separated craft skills from art because the artist didn't touch it. I don't think he even selected it. I think somebody else bought it, but he signed it. And so this is how it has its fame. But there is another context for this work of art, which is never, to my knowledge, explained. Marcel Duchamp was a Frenchman living in New York. And April 1917 was the start of the Nivelle Offensive, of which I'm sure we're all aware. It's not a very famous event, but if I say to you that the prospected casualties of the Nivelle Offensive were 10,000, and the actuality was 118,000, it tells you something about 1917 and the First World War. And what Marcel Duchamp's work, as well as being this formal invention, it's about a Frenchman, albeit living in New York, being slightly disgusted with the world as it was. And his work actually physically manifests a loss of belief in the systems of the 20th century. Loss of belief in monarchy, the church, the state, because the Nivelle Offensive follows on from the Battle of the Somme, the Battle of the tremendous battle at Verdun. Both battles are connected, they were the biggest slaughter in it. And so, in a way, Marcel Duchamp's work is in advance of the historians, because the histories of the time, of which I have a number, portray the battlefield in a kind of heroic manner of a Victorian chaps going over the top, the Hun, the terrible Hun. It's a kind of corny truth. But artists, they didn't only rebel in that idiom. And interestingly enough, probably a more influential artist on painters is Claude Monet. And Claude Monet's studio was slightly under 40 miles behind the front line. In other words, it was one day's march from the front line in 1917. And Claude Monet said, well, it wasn't moving, and he would stay there in Giverny. They'd have to kill him in his studio. And what was he painting? He was painting lilies. How irrelevant could that be in the middle of the First World War, you might ask? Well, not so, I would say, because Claude Monet said it worked in his studio, and he painted these enormous paintings of the water lilies. And he sat in his place, and he made his paintings. And he didn't really control what those paintings mean. But at the end of the First World War, the first trip that Clemenceau, the French president, made out of Paris, first time he left his office, was to visit Claude Monet's studio. And it's kind of a remarkable thing, if you think about it in the context of perhaps Great Britain or somewhere else, the president of France, Georges Clemenceau, he went to Claude Monet's studio because he wanted these paintings for the French nation, and to have them in the Orangerie in Paris. It's one of the if you haven't been, go and see Claude Monet's paintings. They're not decorative paintings. They are paintings of his garden. So the subject is not vital, but unlike Duchamp, he stayed in France. When Clemenceau saw them, he said, "This is the triumph of French culture over barbarism." Now, I don't know whether I necessarily agree with that, but that's how art exists in the world. And it's probably a point where I should take a break, because it brings me onto the lilies, which are in the windows here. But Lady Hale, I don't know if you want to interject.
Ah, well, I want to know what you're going to say about the windows.
All right, first. Well, I can say something.
And then
about
I've got a few questions for you.
Okay,
yes.
Okay. Well, I'll carry on. So the lilies, that's a kind of just a connection, because I've not particularly arranged the nightfall so that you can't see my window. That's just happened chance. But it's an opportunity for you to come back, is how I look at it, on another time and see these windows, because this is the Henry VII Lady Chapel. It's about 500 years, well, it's probably exactly 500 years or 501 years old, built by Henry VII. And it was made as a lantern. So if you look up the magnificent ceiling, you'll see it's like a lantern. All around it's glass. And it's had, I think the word is vicissitudes, this chapel. It's been, a lot of the glass was knocked out by somebody called Oliver Cromwell. The Luftwaffe had a go at it. The man who made the glass was a man called Barnard Flower, and he was Henry VII's glazier. And in those days, you could be an artist and just do stained glass. It's not the same now. You have to do lots of things, but he was a stained glass, and he's a fantastic medieval artist. And if you want to see his work now, you can see it at King's College in Cambridge. And there's also a church in the West Country where the work is almost extant. It's still there. And he did all sorts of things with glass. He made glass painterly. He etched it, and his imagery is fantastically inventive. And he made this glass. So this chapel originally had this explosion of painterly colour. The light floods into it, and that's what makes it the chapel. So I put in a proposal when it was talked about doing these two windows on either side of the central window. Not the central window, that was done by somebody called Alan Younger, I think in the turn of the century time. And so when I put in a proposal, I came here to look at the chapel. And what I took from the chapel, first of all, there's a lot of stuff in this chapel. It's not a white cube. It really isn't white cube, Bermondsey. There's a lot of flags. There's the spectacular ceiling, which is really one of the sort of great masterpieces of late Gothic art. You've got knights. You've got every single square inch of the chapel has got some imprint of the nation on it. 500 years old. It's even got the tomb of Henry VII. And the artist, it's a very interesting story about the artist who made this tomb, Italian artist. And it's spectacular. It's hard to see, but it's there. So it's got all this stuff. So what occurred to me to make the window was that this would be an incredible honour to do, but really what you do, well, you try and fit in, is what you do. You try to make everybody else look okay. You try to restore some of the colour, that Barnard Flower originally had in the window, and we don't know what that is, so they've got to take a guess at that. I thought the principal glory of the chapel is the ceiling, which is a kind of golden colour. So I thought, well, flower, Barnard Flower, his name says flower. Colour, it's gold, so you put blue with gold. So I started thinking along those lines of blue and white that might bring this, because when I looked at the chapel, it seemed to be very, very intense. Then it went up, and then it, with a clear glass, it needed colour. And so the idea was to put colour into it. But what I was not prepared to do was to make an anachronism, to make old-fashioned looking art that mimicked art from the past. It has to be of the here and now. So I had a number of building blocks to put in place. And the flower was the key. I thought, well, what flower? The fleur-de-lis, a symbol of royalty. But it's also the lily. It was Monet's lilies. It's also my mother's perfume, actually. She had a working-class lady's perfume called Lily of the Valley. And I thought, well, that's about... It's a lady chapel, you know? It's about the night sky. It's about the stars. It's about... So what I was very aware of was I was coming into this ancient building which had three kings in it, crowned here in 1066. Well, one king died and two were crowned here in 1066. It has this incredible history. And I suppose a lot of my work is about that. It's about the sense of, not history as being something romantic from the past, but it's about memory. And memory, what we choose to remember, defines who we are. This is a national shrine, and so there are a number of factors filling into this this idea to make the windows. And at this point, I have to mention Helen Whittaker, who was the glass artist who made the windows, and why I mentioned earlier about I don't have a glass studio. I have quite a large studio where I make my paintings, which is primarily what I do, but I don't have a glass studio. And so in my proposal, I said I would work with glass experts. And so Helen was very important. She works at Barley Studios in New York, and I went up to York, and we talked, and we did. So it was a kind of process. And Helen used to come down and to visit my studio and borrow my brushes and take them up, and she hasn't returned them, by the way. And so it was a kind of a collaborative thing, because you have to keep your nerve with something like this. It's a big scenario to put in this something that's lit, and it's about not being frightened about art, and not being frightened about the present, being positive, saying, well, yes, this is a great building, but it is not going to intimidate me. And the windows are meant to enhance the building and to do actually what Gothic art intended to do, is to raise your eyes to the heaven. So the idea is to catch your eye, take you up. So that was the idea behind the windows. But I have no idea how long I've been talking for now, because my mobile phone was confiscated earlier. So I'm going to take this by chance here. But just to say basically that I try to open up some of the things. And the last thing I'll sort of say, actually, is about irony. Marcel Duchamp is Mr. Irony. Right? And what does irony mean? We're told by certain commentators on art, and certain artists, that irony is the only show in town. Well, I don't think it is the only show in town, because basically irony doesn't believe in anything. And whereas you can understand, in April 1917, the French soldiers who went over the top of the Nivelle offensive, in 1914 they went blowing bugles. Alsace-Lorraine, the revenge. They were blowing bugles when they went over the top. And in the Nivelle offensive, they walked forward in a desultory manner, impersonating sheep en route to the abattoir. It was an expression of the common man of irony. And so in 1917, irony was absolutely what an artist might embrace. But in 2000 and wherever it is, 19 we're in, I think it's become an exhausted idiom. And art really needs to start clawing back some belief, some ground, some values. It needs to start pointing again to things that we can respect and live our lives by. All art doesn't have to be a joke. And the kind of artists we tend to know, the ones who did irony the best, Andy Warhol, everybody knows Andy Warhol. He's very funny. He was a great exponent of irony. When irate press commentators said, but Andy, you don't even do these paintings yourself. He said, well, yeah, but they do it so much better than me. Joke, you know. So that's my platform.
Yes, well, thank you. That's a very challenging platform. I've got several questions for you, one of which is, did you know that the seal that we devised for the new UK Supreme Court 10 years ago consists of flowers or plants?
I didn't.
What we have is a Tudor rose to represent England. We have a thistle to represent Scotland. We have a flax flower to represent Northern Ireland. And we have a leek to represent Wales. Apparently the daffodil is not heraldically correct. We have a leek. And I haven't brought it with me, but it's all very beautiful because it is surrounded by what we thought was the just Libra. We didn't want scales because I say that's hackneyed, so we wanted to have Libra, but that's also Omega. So basically we've got the four parts of the United Kingdom surrounded by something that is representative of justice, because it's balance, and it's the final court of appeal. So why do you think we chose flowers?
Well, flowers are emblematic. I should have known this, actually, because we look at things like flowers on the Royal Mint, which I'm involved with, as symbols for the nation. We have to have a symbol for the nation that brings people together, really. Very few people, in my experience, get angry at flowers. They get angry at symbols that are divisive, and it's such a loaded area, really, symbolism. And it's one of the reasons why a lot of artists make very abstract work, because as soon as you move into the area of images, you run the risk of offending people. And it's a very, very, the symbolism of imagery is something that I feel, I don't consult books of symbols when I'm making my work. These ideas come perchance, and interestingly, you were talking earlier about the serpent. I think that has to be Satan, doesn't it? It has to be knocked. It has to be representative of the Garden of Eden and the temptation of vanity, in a way, is what it has to be about. And so symbols, I mentioned Monet, his use of water lilies, and there's often been criticized paintings of flowers. It's one of the things that's most difficult to make, a painting of something that is already in itself beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to make a painting of that. So, but artists have done it, in particular Van Gogh's painting of his sunflowers is a... they're actually dead sunflowers, and it's a very powerful motif in Van Gogh's work. Monet, he reinvented a genre of painting. Flower paintings are usually this size because flowers are that size. Monet's water lily paintings are like, you know, they would fit one of them in this room. So artists have to change things because they have to reflect a new consciousness, a new reality. I think often they get there before historians because they think differently. And when I say artists, I mean poets as well. Probably most of us in England come to the First World War through First World War poetry. And it's a different way of thinking, I suppose, is what I'm saying. And it's often not... it's often hard for an artist to articulate what they're doing. Because when you're doing it, you actually don't really know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm in a profession where I can boast that I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. It doesn't seem to affect things.
No. It's interesting what you say about how easy it is to offend with symbols.
Yes.
Because the reason that we decided not to adopt the royal coat of arms as the symbol of the court was that it would offend two lots of people, one of which were people in Northern Ireland of a particular political persuasion, the other of which was the Scots. Because the quarterings on the royal coat of arms are different in Scotland from the quarterings in England. Yeah. So to use the royal coat of arms was not properly symbolic of all parts of the United Kingdom. So it's interesting what you say about how one can offend. And that's. But another thing prompted by what you said was we did... This took a long time to work out what to do. And the heraldic artist... had quite a lot of ideas, one of which was a lily.
Right.
And you can understand why, really, for all the same reasons that you've been talking about lilies. But, of course, that would have offended Northern Ireland.
Right.
So, at least a certain community in Northern Ireland. Yes. So we were originally going to go with that, and we had to reject that. So very, very interesting. I wanted to ask you, before I ask the... rest of the people whether they have some questions, is you've talked about truth, you've talked about symbols and flowers, and you've talked about irony, and you've also talked about not knowing what you're doing when you're doing it, you know, whereas of course the process I've described is a very conscious.
Absolutely.
If we don't know what we're doing, well then we shouldn't be doing it in my job. So what do you think we judges can learn from you painters that would make us do our judging even better than we believe or hope that we do it now?
Okay, well, I think that's a very difficult question because, well, for all sorts of reasons, but I think in a way the common ground that we have is an idea of the truth, an idea of fairness.
Yes. Yeah.
And so that what we know that there's no such thing as a universal truth. We know that. There's no universal truth. Philosophy students would be able to wipe the floor with any discussion of what a universal truth is or might be. But we do know what our own truth is, in a sense. And I think, in a way, what judges learn is they learn from something that is in the common, in the common parlor, in the common, a bit like the the soldiers at the Nivelle offensive. I don't think the French army ever attacked after that. They never went forward again. And they had mutinies in French army, very famous mutinies, but really somehow the penny dropped first with the poets and the painters. And truth is a move. What's true now is different from what was true 100 years ago. And I suppose that if the question is what could judges learn from the artists, is that things aren't set in stone. It's a fugitive thing. You can't say because it's held true 100 years ago, it holds true now. And so therefore you've got to be constantly alert. And this is like language. There's a powerful argument in which the written language really, once it's written down, it becomes redundant and it changes. If you listen to the vernacular speech of people, language changes and it's constantly evolving and it's actually more fluid. It's better able to respond in its spoken form to the needs of the time. So I think like the common ground between judges and artists is they don't rest on their laurels.
Mm. And the law is a moving...
Yes.
..is a moving thing.
Yes.
Just as the truth is a moving thing.
Yes, absolutely.
And justice is a moving thing.
Absolutely.
A developing thing. Yes. Now, there's a lady there who'd like to make a comment.
If I may.
Yes, of course.
Thank you both so much for absolutely fascinating. But I wondered whether I could... Thank you so much. Whether I could talk... is it on? Yes. Yes. No. It says it's on. If I could ask Lady Hale, you talked about principles and pragmatism. And you talked about sort of the lack of a universal truth, but there is an individual truth. I wonder where you think you could define a principle of legal justice, and from where would you derive it? Because I would assume that there is something universal about a principle of legal justice.
Well, there isn't a single one. It depends what the problem is. I am not going to talk legal theory here or philosophy of law. There are much greater scholars than I will ever be who debate the philosophy of law and the theory of justice or an idea of justice. There are lots of them. From the practical judging point of view, there is an idea, for example, that if somebody is wrongfully harmed by another person, they should be properly compensated for that. And the idea of justice is both there should be compensation, but the compensation should be a proper and fair reflection of the harm that's been done, the loss that they've suffered. Not a penny more, not a penny less sort of thing. Now, that is a principle of justice. It's a concrete principle of justice. We've got loads of them. And we hope that they reflect an idea of justice which has to do with treating people fairly as between one another, not harming people, keeping people to their promises. If I promise you that I will do something and you do something in return, well, then you can keep me to my promise. That's an idea of justice. We've got loads of those sorts of things. But an overarching theme as to what the best justice might be, that is a philosopher's question, which I'm not qualified to answer. And I'm not sure that they are either.
Thank you.
because I think we're into, you know, truth is a movable feast and justice is a movable feast. After all, things like social justice, which does underlie quite a lot of legal development, has done in this century, would not have been regarded as a principle of justice 2 centuries ago. So that's an example of its being a movable feast. Equality, that's a principle of justice. You know, that people should be treated equally without regard to the things, irrelevant qualities like their gender or their ethnicity, yes, or their religion, or their sexuality, whatever. Now, that's a very new idea. It's basically a late 20th century idea. I think it's the greatest development there's been in my professional lifetime, the notion that equality is, in fact, a principle of justice that we ought to do our best to respect. So that's an example of things that have changed over time. It's a movable feast. Is there anything you want to add to that?
I agree with it, no.
All right. Yes, the lady here.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Sometimes technicality gets in the way of the truth,
yes,
in cases. I wondered what you felt about that.
Yes. It does. It particularly gets in the way of fact-finding. After all, there's a truth in ideas, there's a truth in principles, there's a truth in facts. And, of course, a lot of legal proceedings, as I explained, not in my court, but in the trial courts, are about trying to work out what on earth happened, who did what to whom, which is really difficult to do. It's particularly difficult in cases where there aren't written materials which attest contemporaneously to what's been going on, where you've got oral evidence and then you've got problems about who you believe. And we used to have a lot of very technical rules about what was evidence and what was not evidence. And we still have quite a lot of technical rules in criminal cases about what's evidence and what's not evidence. And we've quite a lot of technical rules about what the jury can be told and what they can't be told. This is not the case in most family and civil cases now. Person against person cases rather than state against person. But it's still the case in criminal cases. Now, those rules are there to protect the accused. They're there to reinforce the burden and standard of proof, which is that guilt has a person is presumed to be innocent until they're proved to be guilty, that the burden of proving their guilt lies with the prosecution, and that the prosecution has to prove guilt to the criminal standard, which is beyond reasonable doubt, or sure, is what juries are now told that they must do. And all of these technical rules get in the way of telling the jury everything that the jury might want to know. So that's the biggest area where technicality gets in the way, I think. There's another example which might also fit, which is the advocate's supreme ability to overcomplicate simple issues. And the more money there is involved in a civil case, the more printing ink gets spilled in devising complexities in the hope that the judge will fall for one of those complexities. It's a perfectly okay thing to do. There's no reason why they shouldn't be doing it. It's our job to detect it and see the wood for the trees, basically. It's very, very important. So those are two examples. You're quite right. Sometimes technicality does get in the way. We do our best to overcome the second one, but the first one is there for a reason, and sometimes it's a good reason. But if you've ever sat in a jury and been sent out while there's an argument about whether somebody can say something to you, you'll be frustrated and wonder what on earth the argument's about. And of course, if there's a lawyer on the jury, they can tell you, but they shouldn't. So that's a problem too. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, there's somebody, it's a lady at the back.
Thanks so much for both your presentations. I get a sense that both of you mentioned this idea of envisioning justice around this pursuit of the truth. And often I think truth is one of those things that's very personal, subjective to all of us. And I wonder in your, I guess, in both of your professions, if you've ever had an instance in which you perceive something to be true, but perhaps later in reflection you perceive a different truth, and if so, how you've handled that. Thank you.
Should I go with that?
Yes, yeah, please.
Okay. Yes is the simplest answer. The truth is a kind of constantly shifting scenario for an artist. Actually, a lot of artists recoil from that, and they start... They retreat into style or fashion, and they settle for something, and they just keep doing it. And the obligation of the artist is to do two things: work hard, tell the truth. Now, the truth is the thing they can't grasp, because you keep thinking you've got to some point of certainty about something, and then it moves away. So in a way, by trying to tell the truth, this is what is the artist's obligation. I think the greatest artist, not necessarily the greatest painter, but the greatest artist is Vincent van Gogh. And the reason for that is because it's his attempts to be straightforward are kind of painful. He's quite clumsy. He has all sorts of problems. But there's nothing as compelling as Van Gogh's drawings or his letters or his paintings. And actually, it's the most amazing example of how people get it. He's probably the most popular artist in the world. And I think it's something to do with the fact that he comes quite close to this truth. And when I think of Van Gogh's paintings, I think people often overcomplicate what they're looking at. But if you think of Van Gogh's paintings, they think, well, this is a religious fanatic who's become disillusioned. And in his paintings of the landscape, this is his paintings of God. And it's his version of the truth. Somebody searching for something, constantly searching, never held down a job in his life. But that, and I think that people, I think, understand that when they look at Van Gogh's paintings without necessarily being able to articulate it. So the truth is always subjective, and all views about art are always subjective. So that's the foundation stone. There's never going to be an objective truth, and there's never going to be an objective, you know, people who tell you that Michelangelo is a great artist because they've read it in a book. That's not, you've got to, and so I think art is a particular kind of communication that possibly involves things like faith and something very, very sort of something felt rather than something factual. So you know with art that you're in the area of this, you're always going to be in the area of the subjective. So it throws you back on your human emotions. Sorry, I went off the beam there. But
no, not at all. I have to believe that there are some things that are objectively true in my line of work. You know, the speed limit is 30 miles an hour. If you exceed the speed limit you will commit a criminal offence. Not a very serious one, but you will. So there's loads of stuff in the law that is true in that mundane, objective sense. But as I tried to explain earlier, there are also areas of the law which are not true in that wholly objective sense. They are matters of judgment. They are matters of dispute. The law is quite frequently contested. That's what my court is for. So I could give a mundane example that we've been hearing a case for 2 days. It's about a lot of money, but it's actually about where the dispute about a lot of money should be heard. Should it be heard in England or should it be heard in another country? That's what the dispute's about. And I went into the hearing thinking the answer to each of the issues was X, Y, Z. And I came out of the hearing and our later discussion of the case thinking the answer to those issues is A, B, and C. So I'd perceived a different truth as a result of listening to the arguments, reading some of the materials, discussing it with my colleagues. And I know that others of my colleagues went through exactly the same process, going into the hearing thinking one thing and coming out of it thinking another. I'm sure the lawyers are really pleased to know that, because they are adding value by coming to the hearings.
I'm sure they're relieved that the artists aren't judges as well.
Well, maybe not, but they would like... We've got, of course, quite a lot of artwork around the Supreme Court. Some of it that dates back to when the building was first constructed in 1913, a wealth of Art Nouveau Gothic, Perfum calls it. But we've also got quite a lot of art that we brought in ourselves. And again, exactly as you were saying, the artists had the ideas, but other people executed them.
Yes.
We've got a lot of manifestations on glass. The artist had the idea, but of course glass makers made them. We've got a carpet which is quite famous, and Peter Blake designed the carpet, but of course a carpet maker made it. So we've got lots of examples of what you were talking about. Now, are there any other comments? Yes. That's a wonderful question. Yeah. I'll have to think about it. I don't think there is that parallel, really. I think you can have flowers as symbols of things that the law represents and justice represents. But I think that although justice is an evolving concept, what was just yesterday will be just today, and we're just tomorrow, and we'll be just... You know, it doesn't come and go in the same way that a flower comes and goes. It may evolve and develop in the way that, of course, nature evolves and develops, but it doesn't come and go in that seasonal sense, I don't think. At least I hope not. I hope that we are not different in summer, jollier and happier and generally more generous to people from how we are in winter when we've all gone gloomy. I hope not. But thank you. Are there any other comments or questions? Yes, there's one there.
I had...
Oh, can you speak...
It's
one quick comment, which is that sinners can mean creative things to people. I immediately went, oh, snakes mean knowledge and learning. And like, the snake was dark and thoughtful.
Yes. Yeah. Do you want to have first go at
well,
that?
I will
have a go at it.
Yeah, that's if I get I heard that correctly, how
over-influenced by media reaction.
Yeah, one's work over-influenced by media reaction. Well, I think that is the essential problem of being an artist, really, in a nutshell, really, in a sense. What we want from artists is to be, and I use the example of Van Gogh. Why he's the greatest artist, he was a compulsive truth teller in his art, and not selling any of it was a great assistance to him in this, I think, when he was doing it. He had an almost 100% record of unsold paintings, so he didn't actually have to worry about the audience. Although that's part of the kind of tragic story associated with him. He was supported by his brother. But any artist who gets a bit of success, that really does influence things. And it's often, you know, in the most unexpected ways. When I had a bit of success in the... I found it very, very difficult, actually. It actually brought me to a full stop with my work because whilst I was really comfortable with it when I didn't expect anybody to like it, as soon as people started paying money for it, I started questioning my own integrity and found it very, very problematic. And I think that is a problem for artists. I think the art world is possibly the most unregulated, there's all sorts of people in there. In the art world, not just the artists who are... And so, yet it is this kind of precious thing because we do associate art, particularly now, with some idea of the truth, and we want artists to tell the truth. We want them to do... So it's a huge problem for an artist, I think, you know, because it's not an easy thing. I have three children. And people say, well, are your children artistic? And I say, well, thank God, no. Well, they're quite creative, but do I want them to be artists? No. And so there's a kind of problem with it, I think. Artists have to have some kind of engine, and that's to make them be artists. If they're good artists. And that engine usually is something you wouldn't particularly wish them to have, really, if you know what I mean. Don't know if that makes sense.
No, it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Yes, it makes a lot of sense to me. We've got an interesting... it's not a dilemma. It's a matter of principle. That in this country, and in most, if not all, modern Western liberal democracies, it is a cardinal principle that justice is done in the open. That we don't sit behind closed doors, that people can come and watch our hearings. In the Supreme Court, of course, they are live streamed over the internet, so anybody can watch our hearings anywhere in the world if they've got access to the internet. They'll soon switch off because it's really boring, but nevertheless, it's very important that we do our work in the open. Not only that, of course, we explain our decisions in the way that I've described. It's very important that we explain our decisions. And the principle of open justice has been there for a long time, for two reasons. One of which, of course, is that it's pretty important that people understand what we've done and why we've done it. and that we are able to explain it in a coherent way. But the other is so that we can be accountable, of course, to the public, to the higher courts, if there is one, and so on. So it's a discipline as well as an education. It's both. And so that means that we have to acknowledge that from time to time our decisions are going to be criticised. We always hope that the criticism is expressed in moderate and sensible terms, and mostly it is. There are occasions where it is not so expressed. The most famous occasion was where the Lord Chief Justice, the Master of the Rolls, and Lord Justice Sales, who's now a Justice of the Supreme Court, sitting in the Divisional Court of the High Court, were labelled in a certain newspaper enemies of the people. Now, that sent a chill running down quite a few spines, not only legal spines, I think, because it was thought to go way over the top in criticising the judges, whose decision, incidentally, was completely conventionally, constitutionally correct. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And so it was particularly bad. But on the other hand, we have a free press. They are entitled to say these things, as long as they stick within the realms of the law, and that wasn't illegal to say what they did. There is a member of the government who has a statutory responsibility to uphold the rule of law and the independence of the judiciary. And in my view, it was easy to write the script. It would have gone something like this. In this country, we have a free press. We are very proud of a free press, and it's an important part of our constitution, the Fourth Estate. However, it is my duty, as the member of the government who is charged with defending the independence of the judiciary and the rule of law, to tell you that you are wrong. Simple as that. These were three very senior judges who were doing their job, deciding a case in accordance with the law. And if they're wrong, they will be put right by the Supreme Court, which they weren't. Now, that's an easy script, isn't it? It could have been done immediately. Immediately that came out. Unfortunately, it didn't happen. However, every subsequent person in that position has leapt to the judiciary's defence straight away, because I think everybody was so concerned about those events. And, of course, one could have gone on. The script could have gone on a little bit more than that, but I think that would have been a bit riskier, and it would have gone something like this: beware what you wish for. If you are a newspaper which purports to uphold the rule of law, which that particular newspaper does, if you treat the members of the judiciary who are doing their job in that way, you will be undermining the very thing which you purport to support. Right. Could have gone on to say that. But anyway, the important thing was to say the first thing. And it's a really simple thing to say. And so, but we have got to do our job according to the principles that I was describing earlier. In the glare of publicity, in the knowledge that some of our decisions will not be popular, we do our best to explain them so that people don't get them wrong, and we are having a bit of success in that, but we have to... We swear an oath, and can I just finish by this? We swear an oath to do right to all manner of people after the laws and usages of this realm without fear or favour, affection or ill will. I've sworn that oath, I think, 5 times now, and it still makes me want to cry. But I'm still trying to do it.
Very good. Very good.
I'm sure you're as happy, if not more so than I am, that I don't have to summarise this evening's arguments in the next couple of minutes. But I would like to add my thanks also on behalf of the Dean and Chapter to our speakers this evening for their fascinating contributions, a stimulating evening about the pursuit of truth in what felt to me like a couple of very contrasting but fascinating ways. Thank you also to all of you for coming this evening and for your engagement with the speakers throughout the evening and particularly through the questions. I have now the boring bits to do, which I'm afraid all of these evenings have to finish with. So please do fill in your feedback forms, which you've got on your seats. And in an ideal world, please hand it back to a member of staff. We do review these in considerable depth in the steering group, and it is clearly an important way for us to keep improving the offering that we have through the Institute. The next events in this series are a dialogue focused on music with our own organist and master of the choristers next week at the same time, one on poetry the following week, and then a symposium on art as public service on the 27th of November. Full details are, as always, on our website, and we hope that we'll see many of you at those events as well. The commercial plug, do stop by at the book desk on your way out if you'd like to purchase any of the Institute's books or indeed the definitive history of the Abbey, at least that's what we're claiming, which we launched a few weeks back, I should say, as part of our 750th anniversary celebrations. And last, but definitely not least, you are all very welcome to join us now for a glass of wine, other beverages available, in the Jerusalem Chamber. Thank you very much and enjoy the rest of your evening.